Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The morning din floated above the city like a bank of fog. Portus, the harbor that connected the great imperial city of Rome to the wider Mediterranean world, was awash in the sounds of activity. Sailors carefully pulled huge merchant vessels up to the wooden docks of the enormous, artificial hexagonal harbor. These ships completed journeys that had begun in Egypt, North Africa, Gaul, Spain, Sicily, Greece, and Palestine. Longshoremen unloaded ceramic jugs called amphorae, full of olive oil from Carthage, fish sauce from Tarragona, and wine from Gaza. Sacks full of grain from Egypt and Sicily sat heavy on the porters' backs. Human cargo, slaves, were led in chains down onto the docks. Enormous warehouses along the water stored the goods before they made their final journeys. Carts loaded with that vast array of items wound through the city's crowded streets to another set of docks along an artificial canal where boats waited on the River Tiber to take them upstream to Rome. Other carts clattered onto the pavestones of the winding, hilly, 15-mile road to the city, the Via Portuensis. Vendors hawked glass, marble, bricks, and ceramic tableware. Building sites thrummed with activity, constructing new apartment blocks and warehouses. Bakers churned out loaf after loaf after loaf of rough bread for the thousands of people whose labor made Portus hum. Tavern keepers and wine sellers found plenty of buyers for their food and drink. This was the Roman Empire at its peak. Constant movement, binding together huge cities all around the Mediterranean in a web of trade, migration, and shared culture. Cities were the places where famous orators spoke, philosophers lectured, and poets performed. They were the venues for gladiatorial games and Christian martyrdom. They were centers of commercial demand and consumption, drawing in a staggering array of goods from all around the Mediterranean and beyond. They were the political centers where aristocrats went to spend their money and compete with each other for office and prestige. They were home to the great monuments we associate with the Romans, the baths, theaters, palaces, basilicas, and arenas. Cities were what made Romans, Romans. From Wondery, this is Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thank you for joining me here today. When we think of the Roman Empire, cities are what come to mind. Rome itself is the best example of this. The monstrous bulk of the Colosseum, the triumphal arches, the ruins of the Forum, the great columns, they all stand as a mute testament to the glory of a past empire. But it wasn't just Rome. The Roman Empire was an empire of cities. There were York and London in Britain, Merida and Tarragona in Spain, Carthage and Hippo Regius in North Africa, Athens and Corinth in Greece, Alexandria in Egypt, and Antioch in Syria. And those are just a few. Depending on how you define them, there were hundreds, maybe thousands of cities in the Roman Empire. Urban life was central to the empire's economy, society, politics, and culture. Cities bound the Roman world together as nexuses in the network of trade and movement. They were focal points for its administration. They were where Roman society and culture, especially aristocratic society and culture, took place. In today's episode, we'll discuss how these cities came into being, how they functioned, and what made them so central to Roman life for so many centuries. Eventually, though, city life declined and then disappeared entirely from huge stretches of Western Europe. Roman urbanism died, faster in some places than others. How and why that happened will be the topic of next week's episode. we need to begin today with a paradox. I've already talked about how important cities were to the Roman economy, to its politics, and most of all, to how the Romans saw themselves. But only 10 or at most 20% of the Roman population actually lived in a city. In the most urbanized region of the empire, wealthy and exceptionally fertile Egypt, maybe 40% of the population lived in cities. For comparison, about 80% of Americans live in cities today. By our standards, the Roman world was incredibly rural. If that was the case, why does it seem so urban, and why were cities so important? Well, on the one hand, it's because of what came before and after. You see, urbanism, the habit of living in cities and everything that went along with it, wasn't native to most of Western Europe before the Roman Empire took over. There were no cities in most of northern Italy, Gaul, Spain, and Britain until the Romans built them. So, it should come as no surprise that when the Roman Empire fell apart, so did most of those cities. Not completely, except in spots, but enough that the contrast between classical antiquity and the Middle Ages has an enormous urban versus rural dimension to it. Roman rates of urbanization in most of Western Europe wouldn't be reached again until the late Middle Ages, and even then, not everywhere. Impressive city ruins add to that impression that Roman life was urban life. But it's not just an impression. For the Romans themselves, cities were potent symbols of what made them who they were. Whether it was on the fringe of the Sahara in Mauritania, in the hills of central Italy, or along the Rhine in Germany, whether it had hundreds of thousands of inhabitants or just a few thousand, Roman cities shared a set of basic characteristics. First, a Roman city had monumental buildings. It had baths, temples, a forum, markets, and other staples of Roman life. The layout and structures weren't identical everywhere, but some combination of big, important-looking structures was essential. Second, it had roads, and usually rivers or seaports as well, leading in and out. Cities of every size were central points in trade networks, so goods and people had to get there somehow. Internally, an organized grid of streets was usually a strong marker of city status. Third, cities were self-governing. The elite citizens of the city formed a council, a curia in the Latin-speaking West and a bulla in the Greek-speaking East. These elites competed for official positions. They assessed and collected taxes. They carried out necessary services, like infrastructure maintenance and the construction of public buildings. They guaranteed the supply of grain to the city's inhabitants. They put on games for the people, too, providing entertainment in the form of public executions, gladiatorial games, beast hunts, and the like. Now, all of this is a simplification. There was a tremendous amount of diversity. Some cities, like Rome, Alexandria, Antioch, Carthage, and eventually Constantinople, were enormous. They had hundreds of thousands of inhabitants and a vast array of huge monumental buildings. Others, like Saint-Bertrand-de-Comminges and the Gallic foothills of the Pyrenees, or Silchester in southern Britain, had only a couple thousand inhabitants and just a few major buildings. Some were laid out from the very beginning with highly organized street grids. Others had a chaotic street plan smoothed into something better over time. Some had a centuries or millennia-long history that predated Roman rule. Others were brand new foundations. Urbanism had been a feature in the Eastern Mediterranean for a long time before the first Roman army ever stepped foot in Asia. In Phoenicia, cities like Sidon and Tyre were already ancient when Rome was nothing more than a collection of little huts along the Tiber. Greek cities are a bit younger than that, but they were still many centuries old when Rome took control of the East. The urban framework was already in place there, so it was a pretty simple matter for the Romans to fit these places into a system of imperial rule. That wasn't the case in the West. there were no cities in the sense the Romans would have understood them in most of Gaul, Iberia, Britain, or Germany. Those cities that did exist had been planted pretty much by the Greeks or the Carthaginians. Urbanism was an import, something that came along with Roman armies, Roman merchants, Roman wine, and Roman beliefs about how you organized society. I want to stop for a moment and talk about that last piece. Cities weren't just places where people came together to live or trade. They were reflections of a whole view of how people related to each other, of how political power functioned, of how the world was supposed to work. Cities can't be separated from how people think about them. Roman cities reflected the Roman understanding of those things. Let's take Gaul, basically present-day France, as an example of this. It's not like there weren't settlements in Gaul prior to Caesar's conquest in the 50s BC. There were, plenty of them. Caesar called them oppida. An oppidum was generally a fortified site that combined political, religious, and economic functions. Most of them were small, with a few hundred inhabitants, though a couple were bigger, with a couple thousand inhabitants. Now, archaeologists and historians who work on pre-Roman Gaul and Roman Gaul have spent literally decades arguing over whether these oppida should be considered cities. That debate is less important than one basic fact. Whatever you think oppida were, after the Roman conquest, they were replaced by towns and cities that looked and acted a lot like Roman towns and cities everywhere else in the Roman Empire. How the Gauls became Roman was a long and complicated process. It's not as simple as saying they adopted Roman culture, because that implies that there was a singular Roman culture to adopt and that you could do it overnight. That's not the case. There's a great book on this process called, pointedly enough, Becoming Roman, by a historian named Greg Wolf that I highly recommend if you're interested in the details. But regardless of how you think about quote-unquote Romanization, cities were central to that process. They were especially important for getting the most important people in those newly conquered regions, the elites, to buy into the cultural package that Rome was selling. In the East, not that much had to change. Elites were already based in cities, and Roman aristocrats really didn't look down their noses at educated Greek city councilmen. That wasn't the case in the West. From the Roman perspective, the nobles of a Gallic tribe were barbarians. To be fully brought into the Roman fold, to be trusted with ruling these places in Rome's name, they had to act like Romans. They had to speak Latin and get a proper education. Most of all, they had to live in a Roman city. The process of building cities went hand in hand with bringing these newly conquered elites into agreement with Roman norms and values. Roman provincial governors encouraged the process. Listen to this quotation from the Roman writer Tacitus about his father-in-law Agricola, who was the governor of Britain in the 1st century AD. Quote, "To induce a people, hitherto scattered, uncivilized, and therefore prone to fight, to grow pleasurably inured to peace and ease, Agricola encouraged individuals and assisted communities to build temples, public squares, and proper houses. He trained the sons of the leading men in the liberal arts. Our national dress came into favor, and the toga was everywhere to be seen." And so, they strayed into the enticements of vice, porticos, baths, and sumptuous banquets. In their innocence, they called this civilization, when in fact, it was part of their enslavement. Now that's a breathtakingly cynical view from Tacitus, but we don't have to accept his cynicism to see the connection he's drawing between the material existence of the city and the essence of being Roman. These new elites weren't just doing this to get cozy with the Romans either. Building impressive city buildings made them look important to their own subordinates. Imagine you're a dirt-poor farmer in Gaul in, say, 40 BC. You've just lived through an incredibly traumatic conquest at the hands of the Romans. You know people who have been killed, people who've had their crops burned or stolen, and your whole world has been turned upside down. Why would you keep listening to the nobles? they lost the war. But if these nobles start building baths and temples, these visible symbols of Roman power, maybe you're more inclined to go along with them. For these local aristocrats, building cities in the Roman fashion showed the new conquerors that they were buying into the program. It showed the common folks that their leaders had access to a new and potent form of power.
If you're like me, traffic is part of your everyday life. Start, stop, start, stop, start, stop. Yell at somebody who cuts you off. It's the daily dance we do. But Audible makes traffic an escape you look forward to. In your car, access an unbeatable selection of bestsellers, mysteries, thrillers, and motivation. I'm recommending Thomas F. Madden's Venice, A New History. It's a fantastic, entertaining narrative of one of the most fascinating and important places in the history of the last 1,000 years, where things like capitalism and banking were invented and honed. Get a free audiobook like Venice, A New History, with your 30-day trial at audible.com/tides. That's audible.com/tides. Once more, that's audible.com/tides. Try Audible today.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
The process of building these cities was inseparable from the process of becoming Roman. It wasn't an overnight thing. They didn't go to sleep one night in wooden longhouses as Gallic barbarians and wake up the next morning in elegant Roman townhouses with papyrus scrolls full of Cicero on the shelves and nice mosaics on the floor. There was no, "Oh, hey, I'm a Roman now" moment. It took decades, centuries, for these Roman ways of life to embed themselves in the hearts and minds of people in what was becoming the Roman West. It was about repetitive, daily behavior carried out in the physical space of these new cities. Thousands of people made decisions in hundreds of different places that added up to an enormous change. An aristocrat decided to construct a Roman-style temple. An aspiring city councilman decided to use his money to put up a public bathhouse. An up-and-coming merchant built a fancy townhouse for himself like ones he'd seen in Milan or Marseille. A former tribal war leader made sure his sons were educated in the Roman fashion and that they took their lessons in the forum of a new city. A talented blacksmith left the countryside and set up shop in the suburbs. A potter opened a workshop, saw her neighbors using imported wares from Italy, and made her own imitations of those imported wares to sell. By including more and more monumental buildings in the Roman style, cities reflected the increasingly Romanized populace. But they were also active agents of that increasing Romanization. Our built environments condition us in all sorts of ways and encourage particular kinds of cultural processes and social relations. Think about the difference between living in a low-density suburb versus a hyper-dense urban area. You relate to your neighbors differently. You have a different understanding of space. You consume different kinds of goods. You spend your free time in different ways. The same was true in the Roman world. Publicly built and funded bathhouses speak to a particular view of the body and of personal interaction. Forums were places of public oration, law, and education. The gladiatorial games, executions, and beast hunts that took place in arenas reinforced the idea of Roman superiority and Roman community. Great temples replaced small altars, and cities adopted a whole different form of religious belief. Bustling markets full of goods imported from Spain, Italy, North Africa, and the Eastern Mediterranean showcased the wide horizons of a Roman world. Soon, you bathed in those bathhouses, you attended those games, you met friends and political allies in the forum, you sacrificed in temples, and you bought goods in markets. You were a Roman. Beyond daily life, cities were central to how the Romans organized and ran their empires. They thought of the political landscape in terms of cities. Cities had territories, and they were responsible for administering those territories. For the Romans, having a territory to control was actually what defined a settlement as a city, rather than just a collection of people. The Roman Empire literally couldn't function as a political unit without cities. They were the fundamental language through which the Romans thought about political control. If cities didn't already exist someplace, they would need to create them. Otherwise, how are they supposed to run things? They literally couldn't think about it any other way. The elites of this newly conquered territory would be drawn to the city, where they competed for political offices, like spots on the Curia, the city council. The Roman authorities only really dealt with them. In return for administering this city and territory, they got to stay in charge. The Curia assessed and carried out taxation, which was their most important function, but they also did a bunch of other useful stuff. They guaranteed the grain supply, which was never a given in a world of constant food shortages. They built and maintained infrastructure, like streets, aqueducts, and canals. They funded the construction of the public buildings we've talked about. As part of the process of competing for offices, they gifted games, food, and just straight-up money to the people. Aristocrats wanted people to know about their generous acts. Listen to this inscription from the temple of the imperial cult in Lyon in Gaul. Quote, "In honor of Quintus Julius Servianus, the Sequanian, who had performed all the offices among his own people and was patron of the magnificent guild of the shippers of the Rhone and the Saone, and was twice decreed statues by the council of his own state on account of his integrity. The three Gallic provinces voted this in his honor on the occasion of his holding the post of Inquisitor of the Gauls." You can hear the civic pride there, right? Quintus Julius Servianus was by definition a member of the elite, but what mattered to him, what he wanted to display for posterity, was what he'd done for his fellow citizens. What made him an important person, a person worth remembering, wasn't his wealth. It was his public service. That is a fundamental expression of the ideology that made Roman cities work on every level. The Roman world was incredibly unequal. Elites cornered power, authority, and wealth to an extent that's really, really hard for us to imagine. But they were expected to give back to their cities, to show their civic pride in material terms, in order to be considered a true, worthwhile aristocrat. That social pressure to give was a powerful force. You may have noticed that the view I'm presenting here is heavily focused on the elite. There's a good reason for that. Cities wouldn't have existed without them. It was a particularly Roman ideology of aristocratic values and politics, not some natural force of gravity that pulled elites from the countryside into the city. The historian Greg Wolf sums it up nicely. Quote, the cities of Gaul were built because the richest and most influential citizens of Gallic communities learned to associate civic life with civilization. But it didn't matter whether you were a city council member in an out-of-the-way town in Britain or the richest senator of Rome. You ultimately derived your wealth from your country estates. Don't get me wrong, these elites almost always had urban investments too, sometimes extensive ones. They might have owned apartment buildings, workshops, tanneries, bakeries, or warehouses. But it was rural estates that generated the baseline economic surplus that elites spent in towns and cities. Economic activity followed elites. When elites competed for political office, like we talked about, and those city council positions and responsibilities to show that they were Roman aristocrats, then cities prospered economically. All of that pulled surpluses out of the countryside and into the city. The money elites brought into those urban communities got spent over and over and over again, creating a cycle of prosperity that connected city and countryside into a coherent unit. So we've talked a lot about cities as markers of Roman cultural identity, as the sites of social interaction and acculturation, and as political centers. Now, I want to talk about cities in an economic sense. To do that, we'll have to touch a bit on the Roman economy and how it worked. If you'd like a deep dive on this, head back to episodes 11 and 12 of my old Fall of Rome show, and you'll get a good sense for the big picture. Even though the vast majority of people in the Roman Empire lived and worked in the countryside, cities were the backbone of what made the empire's economy work. They, and what they enabled, were why the standard of living during the first couple of centuries AD was higher than it ever had been before or would be again until at least the late medieval period, if not even later. What cities enabled was movement of people, but especially of goods. As we discussed, cities were the center of a territory. Each was connected to a broader, more rural region, and that meant that people and goods from the surrounding region traveled there. But cities were also distinct points in a larger urban network that connected cities to each other. Rome was connected to Carthage in North Africa, Arles in Gaul, Tarragona in Spain, Syracuse in Sicily, and Alexandria in Egypt. Arles, the gateway to Gaul, was connected via the Rhone River to Lyon and from there to all of inland Gaul. Carthage was the point of connection for the rest of the African cities to the outside world. Each Mediterranean megalopolis, like Rome or Constantinople, was connected to smaller regional cities, and the smaller regional cities were connected to still smaller cities. The routes that connected those cities were made up of roads, rivers, and sea lanes. Airports are a good modern parallel for this. You generally don't go from the regional airport in Yakima, Washington, or Cedar Rapids, Iowa, straight to Tokyo, Dubai, or London. Instead, you go from the small airport to a larger one, Seattle, Chicago, or Dallas, and then from there to your final destination. To get from one place to another, you have to go through these major points in the network. The Roman world worked the same way. Let's say you're distributing mass-produced pottery from North Africa. First, you'd ship it from Carthage to Rome, Arles, Tarragona, and your other major coastal cities. From there, it'd be distributed further by small ships along the coast, by river barges, or overland by road. In the Roman world, it wasn't just pottery. It was also grain, olive oil, a pungent fish sauce called garum that the Romans loved. It was wine, and it was textiles. These were all bulk, staple goods, not luxury items. For it to be worth it to ship those kinds of goods, the cost of transportation had to be really low, and the volume had to be extremely high. This sounds basic, but it's a hugely important point about the Roman economy. You know, luxury goods, these small quantities of really valuable items like silk or jewelry, they'd been moving around the Mediterranean since the Bronze Age. Luxury goods would continue moving even into the depths of the early medieval depression that followed the fall of the Roman Empire. But bulk goods were a different story. The profit margins were lower. For bulk goods to work as commodities, the markets for those goods had to be much more highly developed. There had to be better infrastructure. There had to be more traffic in general. Most of all, there had to be information flowing to set market prices. In other words, these distinctive features of the Roman economy, what separated it from what came before and what came after, none of that could exist without a network of big, tightly connected cities. These cities were both created by the economy and the creators of it.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
So this gets at a really important debate that scholars have had about both cities and about the nature of the Roman economy. For a long time, it was fashionable to see Roman cities as consumer cities. From this point of view, cities were basically just a playground for the elite to show off their wealth and status and play political games to shore up their legitimacy and their authority. Cities leached resources out of the productive countryside. While they were important to the self-image and the power of the aristocracy, cities, in this view, didn't really offer anything to the Roman economy. This point of view connects with a specific view of the Roman economy as a whole. Scholars call it the primitivist position. In this context, primitivist doesn't mean primitive. It means that these scholars emphasize the ways in which the ancient economy was unlike our own. This view focuses on how the elite's hunger for power and status drove them toward rent-seeking behavior and land ownership rather than commercial enterprise. It also emphasizes the role of the Roman state in distorting market conditions for its own purposes. It minimizes the role of markets. A view of cities as artificially created, artificially supported leeches fits nicely with this perspective. Now, these historians aren't necessarily wrong. The Roman state did play a huge role in the economy. It guaranteed contracts, it provided and maintained a dense infrastructure of roads and ports, and it set a baseline level of demand for staple goods like grain and oil to feed the biggest cities and, of course, the army. Cities couldn't have existed without free or subsidized grain for the populace. The elite did do a lot of rent-seeking, and their ideology of power and authority did lead them to do a bunch of things that aren't aimed strictly at maximizing profit. But at the end of the day, that's not how I see things. I choose to emphasize the more modern-seeming aspects of the Roman economy. It was fully monetized, not just in the sense that people used money, but that people thought of the value of goods and services in monetary terms. Rural estates and businesses were run with principles in mind that we would consider economically rational. Even aristocrats, who we're supposed to think were irrational rent seekers, were economically diversified and had a whole variety of profitable commercial ventures in their portfolios. Most of all, though, commercial markets were hugely important to the Roman economy. The state may have set a baseline level of demand for goods, but the vast majority of trade in the Roman Empire was handled through private, price-setting commercial markets. Rural production was, in large part, geared around producing for those commercial markets. That easy movement of goods and people, the low cost and risk of transportation, the constant flow of information that allowed prices to be set, all of that allowed different regions to specialize in different things.
Now, this doesn't mean that we should view Romans as neat little proto-capitalists acting in accordance with perfect, frictionless models of how markets work. Any competent economist working today will tell you about the limitations of the models you learn in Economics 101. But all of that does mean that markets were really important to the functioning of this economy. The implications of this are huge. It meant that cities didn't have to be self-sufficient. They didn't have to pull all of their subsistence from their local regions. Because cities were tightly connected to one another, you could easily ship grain from Carthage to Rome, Sicily to Aquileia at the mouth of the Adriatic, or Marseille to Tarragona. You didn't have to invest in vineyards on land that was marginal for the purpose. You could import it from Gaul or Greece or even Gaza. You could produce your olive oil and fish sauce in Spain and ship it all over the Mediterranean. This allowed for regional specialization and economies of scale, which increased supply and reduced prices, so long as you could get those cheap bulk goods from place to place. Now you can see, Roman cities were essential to this economic setup. It's why the idea of them as consumer cities just leeching off the productive countryside is misleading. Cities didn't just redistribute or misuse the fruits of rural labor. Their existence created wealth for the entire Roman Empire, including the countryside. They were the points of connection that tied together this whole complex, highly developed economic system. They allowed for the easy distribution of all these bulk goods that each specialized rural agricultural region was producing. They were also centers of concentrated demand for products, especially agricultural products. On the flip side, cities were also centers of production to meet mass demand in rural regions. People in those rural areas had money to spend on consumer goods because of the existence of cities, because they increased the scale and productivity of rural agriculture to feed and supply those huge gatherings of people. This is all kind of abstract, though. Let's take a step back. Imagine yourself living in one of these cities, a middling inhabitant of a middling city. It could have been Mérida in Spain, it could have been Hippo in North Africa, Narbonne in Gaul, or Salona in Dalmatia along the Adriatic. You might have been a baker, a small banker, a shop owner, or a skilled builder. No matter where you were, there were strong similarities. Your city had public buildings and spaces. Baths, temples, a theater and arena, a forum, markets. You had a city council that ran things. They ensured that everybody got enough grain to live on, and they paid for the upkeep and the construction of both public buildings and vital infrastructure. If you had a shop, you lived in an apartment above or behind your storefront, which faced onto a narrow, paved street. You might have cooked food at home if you had a real house with a kitchen, or you got your meals from taverns or street vendors. Chances are good that your city was growing. It was prosperous. No matter what city you lived in, it was impossible to escape the fact that you were part of a larger Roman world. Everywhere around you were reminders of how connected you were to other cities and other places. You heard a variety of languages. You heard Latin, Greek, Syriac, Punic, and many others. Ships arrived from other ports bearing cargoes of both the exotic and the mundane. You got grain from Sicily, Egypt, North Africa. You drank wine from Gaul, Italy, Greece. You ate off ceramic plates from Africa and Italy. In a real sense, that connectedness, that sense of being part of a city in a broader Roman world, was what made you Roman. Up until the 3rd century AD, Roman cities and the Roman Empire thrived. This is the period we call the Pax Romana. The population of the empire peaked. So did the proportion of people living in cities. The economy, not coincidentally, was also at its very height. But this was a fragile system. It depended on the stability of the Roman Empire to exist. It required well-maintained infrastructure. You needed public order. You needed contract enforcement. You needed grain subsidies. Cities couldn't survive on their own in the West, and neither could the economy that ran through them. As the Roman Empire in the West fell apart, so did its cities. Their populations died or fled. That ideology of civic virtue that kept elites spending their money on their home cities died out.
The tax system broke down, and so did the subsidies that fed and supplied the biggest cities. Slowly in some places, quickly in others, the cities that had defined the Roman Empire and the Roman world more broadly died out. How and why that happened will be the topic of the next episode of Tides of History. We'll follow the long decline of Roman cities from the 3rd century up to the 6th. Why did Mediterranean cities continue to thrive, albeit in diminished form, while those in Britain and northern Gaul fell apart entirely? How did a contracting economy play into this? We'll look at all this and more next week. When we return to Rise of the Modern World next month, we'll be looking at the transformation of the medieval economy and the rise of capitalism, a force that still defines our world today. I'd love to chat with you about the fall of Rome and the rise of the modern world, so be sure and drop me a line on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, and everywhere else you get your podcasts. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound designer is Jeff Schmidt. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. From Wondery, the producer is Leah Sutherland. The executive producers are Ben Adair and Hernan Lopez. Thanks for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.